Oh, hello. It's nice to be in Minnesota again. I lived here from 1999 to 2000, teaching at the University of St. Thomas. And it's a very different world from the world I know, but I liked it. And I haven't been back since, so it's nice to be here. I'm glad to hear that Dr. Brennan and I agree on so much. We spent most of dinner disagreeing on a great number of things. It was actually quite a lot of fun. I'm relieved to discover our disagreements are not all that unites us. The title of the lecture, I believe, that I provided was Nihilism and Freedom, Is There a Difference? Or something. I didn't mean that to be purely an ironic title or a snide title. There is a genuine point behind that. It's a genuine question. Let me begin by breaking with my script and relate to you an anecdote that set me off on a course of reflection some years ago when I was teaching at the University of Virginia. A very talented undergraduates at Virginia are allowed to live on the lawn. That is, the part of the college that was built in Mr. Jefferson's day, and that it's a high honor. It's not a great convenience because that part of the college was built before indoor plumbing. But the best and the brightest end up there. And a few years ago, a very talented young man committed suicide on the lawn in his rooms, hanged himself. And no one could figure out why. But a friend of mine who knew several of his friends discovered, and it soon emerged over the course of time, that not only were some of them aware that he intended to kill himself, but that they had made no effort to prevent him from doing so. And when asked why, they said, well, it was his choice. We had to respect his choice. That was the way he chose to go. Now, I don't know if this anecdote tells us anything about modern times or not, but I do know that the question that story raised for me then and does now is at what point did it become plausible for not one but three or four reasonably bright young men simply to stand aside and allow a friend of theirs to kill himself on the grounds that his choice was to kill himself, and that there's no higher value or no greater concern that should be invoked. So that's the beginning of my reflections. The other thing I want to say, starting from that anecdote, and I hope to fill it out later, is that when I use the term nihilism or nihilism, if you prefer, I'm not using it as an opprobrious term. I want first and foremost to clarify that. I am using it in a very purely technical sense, for the most part, devoid of any intentional connotations, of any intention of deprecation. It is, especially in continental philosophy today, there are those who quite happily identify themselves as nihilists. Gianni Vattimo still uses that term for himself. And all he means by that is that he has, as a matter of intellectual honesty and a matter of principle, come to believe that there is no transcendent structure to reality. There is no eternal or transcendent order of truths to which the philosopher or anyone else has access, that whatever ethics we live by, whatever values we hold dear, they're generated imminently within the world. It's part of the economy of culture. It's part of the sheer fortuity of history. And for Vatimo, this in itself, nihilism is quite possibly the most peaceful intellectual condition possible. Because it's a style of thought that once it fully realizes itself as nihilism, once it fully relinquishes the desire to grasp the eternal principles by which we should live or by which the world should be governed or by which we should understand the nature of truth, once it has relinquished the desire to master the real by force, as he would put it, by fixing in mind and then in action those eternal, unchanging truths by which all of reality should be governed, it is able simply to let the world be world. It is potentially that style of thought which, because it doesn't presume that it has any higher truth that ought to be imposed on other people, can become the form of thought that truly liberates us from our history of violence, our history of greed, our history of cruelty. So simply said, what nihilism is in a technical sense is the rejection of any source of objective truth, meaning, or value independent of the self or the world. It's a condition of conscious disenchantment in which every metaphysical discourse and every religious claim has been abandoned. One of the benign uses of the word nihilism was offered by Martin Heidegger. He said, what would be a realized nihilism? A nihilism that has gone beyond the metaphysical urge to master reality and control it. It would be to allow the world to world in its worlding. It doesn't sound any better in German, actually, that one. For Heidegger, for those of you who have or haven't read him, it doesn't really matter. For Heidegger, there is this, what is reality ultimately? It is simply the coming to presence of beings. Things come into being, waver for a time in the openness of the world, and disappear again. The pathology of metaphysics that he denounces continuously in his work, the thing that he thinks leads ultimately to a bad kind of nihilism, which I'll discuss in a moment, starts for him very early in the history of Western thought. It starts for him in the time of Plato. When Plato, confronted by the mystery of the world, by the mystery of its coming to be and passing away, decided that to understand it, he had to grasp the world under the form of eternal and unchanging principles. So he turned away from the world and its worlding. He turned away from the simple event of the world around him towards eternal ideas, and thought that if he could capture those ideas, this is Heidegger's narrative, in so doing, he would capture the mystery of being at the same time. He would grasp the unshaken foundation of reality and achieve a kind of mastery over truth. And for Heidegger, the whole history of Western thought, pagan and Christian, and I'd say Jewish, except that the Jews don't appear in Heidegger's thought, and it would be embarrassing for him if they did, given his political history, but the whole history of this tradition is one or another of a series of successive attempts to grasp reality under the forms of one or another set of changeless principles. It might be ideas, it might be a particular understanding of act and potency. It might be under the form of God, the Christian metaphysics that understands God as the supreme being who in his changeless eternity grounds and establishes the truth and reality of the changing world below. But what's been lost for Heidegger all along the way is the true mystery of being. The true mystery of being is not something eternal, is not something changeless, is not something that the mind or the will can master. It is this inexpressible mystery of the event, this inexpressible mystery of all things coming to be and passing away. And for Heidegger, the bad nihilism at which we've arrived, the most nihilistic nihilism possible, is that of the modern age, the age of technology, in which this desire to master the real by force has actually become a concrete technological mastery of the world, in which everything has been reduced to a bare interplay of power and resources. That is, the power of the individual to master the world, and the world itself is simply so much matter, so much material, so many resources to be mastered. So are we following this so far? We've arrived at a moment in history in which, due to this long Western tradition, we are now unable to think of reality in terms other than what is available for our use and how we can dominate it and exploit it. And within that reality, everything is lost. One of his most famous, little passage from one of his works, Frage Noch Technik, the question concerning technology. He says, in this age in which we represent the world as nothing but a bare coherence of cause and effect, the efficient cause, the power to make and the power to possess, even God loses all that is exalted and holy, the mysteriousness of his distance. In the light of this causality, God just sinks to the level of a cause, causa efficiens. He then becomes, even in theology, the God of the philosophers, namely of those who define what happens in the world only in terms of the causality of mastery, of making, of exploitation, and of force. All right. I think, obviously, to some extent, I want to endorse the Heideggerian history of thought and say that that there's some truth in it. But another way of defining nihilism, then, and I'll get back to Heidegger later, would be the age of freedom understood in a very specific way. That is, well, how do we understand freedom now? Usually as the unobstructed power of choice. Now, in some sense, something like that, the power to choose, the power to determine ourselves, is part of any coherent definition of freedom. But for the most part, as moderns, as persons who live within the language and practices and habits of thought of modernity, that's all that freedom is. That's the highest expression of freedom. And it may be, for all I know, but let's just situate ourselves historically. We believe, more or less unreflectively, even those of us who are formerly Christians or Jews or believing pagans or whatever, that the will necessarily becomes more free the more it is emancipated from whatever constraints it suffers. And over the course of time, as we've seen just as a fact of history, this means that even what at one time were cherished restraints of the will, things that we thought were indispensable, over time come to seem onerous because they are just so many obstacles thrown up before us in the exercise of our will. And I think this is an uncontentious assertion. I mean, the whole history of modern political, economic, and social doctrine is, to a large degree, the long, laborious history of Western culture's departure from a certain classical and Christian view of freedom that worked very differently. And, of course, the ascendancy of the language of rights over other understandings of social freedom, which again, I'm not saying is a bad thing. I'm just saying this is where we are. And a society that really believes, that truly, honestly believes that the highest good, excuse me, as always happens with me when I'm talking, I'm always on some medication or another which causes me to perspire. It's just one of the laws of my existence these days. In this case, a culture that believes that this is the highest model of freedom must, at some level, subtly advocate and embrace a very particular moral metaphysics. That is, that ultimately there really is no value higher than choice. There is no transcendent good ordering desire towards a higher end. Desire should be free to propose or seize or accept or reject or want or not want, but it certainly shouldn't necessarily be free to obey. That would be a kind of sedition. The highest model of freedom we're all likely to recognize, I think at times, is that of the good consumer. I mean, we are free to the degree that we can, you know, the number of different brands of bread we can buy. I can purchase 57 different brands of bread, therefore I am free. I'm not in a trivial sense. At the end of modernity, this is where we stand. We are free to make ourselves what we wish to be. If we were not free, in that sense, we would not be free at all. Now, when I say this is a break with an earlier understanding of freedom, I mean that in classical terms, in pagan or Christian terms, up until a very identifiable point in modern history, early modern history, or late medieval history, if you like, freedom was the ability to flourish as the kind of being one was. Freedom was principally the ability to attain the ontological good by which one's nature would reach fulfillment. This could be human excellence, this could be the contemplation of God, this could be charity. But freedom, in this sense, meant that the movement of the will was posterior in importance, but also posterior effectively, to the object of its intentions. It was something that was moved or wakened by a desire for some proper telos, some proper end that guided and determined it. And that was only free and so far, to the degree that it achieved that telos. It was not free because it could choose, it was free because it chose well. It was free when it was not prevented from realizing the good towards which its nature was oriented, towards which our nature was oriented. To choose falsely through ignorance or maleficence or corrupt longing would not be considered a manifestation of freedom. That would just be slavery to the imperfect, the deficient, or the literally subhuman. The antique understanding of freedom this is as true of Stoicism as of Platonic philosophy, as Aristotelian, middle Platonic thought, late Platonic thought, Christian thought in its patristic and medieval variants, and there are no figures in that tradition you can point to who break with this rule, so to speak. Whatever separates us from that end, which fulfills our nature, even if it's our own choices, is a form of bondage. We are not free because we can choose. We are free if we choose well. So sorry to repeat it. And to choose well, we ever more clearly have to see the good, the son of the good, to use the Platonic language. And yet to see more clearly, we must choose well. And the more we're emancipated from illusion, the more our will is informed by the good, the more perfect our vision becomes, and the less there is really to choose. And the highest state of freedom would be a state of freedom in which there's no choice, because we've realized the perfect flourishing of our nature in union with the first good towards which we're united. Augustine, for instance, said that, you know, the freedom from which we began in creation was the freedom not to sin, but the highest freedom of all would be the inability to sin, because the inherent goodness of the human will and its desire for God will be so perfectly realized that it will adhere to the good. Or a great father that I prefer, actually, on most metaphysical issues, Maximus the Confessor, said the same thing, that in us as finite beings, we have two motions of the will. One is the natural motion of our will, which can never be extinguished, which is towards the good, which is towards God. But by that motion, it sets free all other motions of the will. And the will also has what he calls a gnomic or a deliberative function. And to be truly free, one's gnomic will, that is, one's ability to deliberate, has to be in perfect harmony with the nature that defines us. Now, again, I'm not offering these definitions so that I can then begin to inveigh against modernity. I mean, I'm quite happy to do that. It's just that's not my purpose. Because my real question, I mean, because anyone can see where the limitations of the language of freedom in either model lie. That I prefer the older model simply has to do perhaps with confessional allegiances, though I also like to think that there's some degree of thought involved in that. But I'll explain that later. What I want to know, the question I asked is, first, how it is we moved from one model of freedom to the other, why we did, and is it the case that other model of freedom, if it is freedom as such, means that to be consistent in our understanding of what it is to be free, we also have to be consistently nihilistic in our metaphysics. Can we be free in the modern sense until we have done what we must do and killed God? Because in the second view, this more modern view of freedom, nature is a confining concept. Nature, to speak of realizing human nature, means that there is some sort of thing we ought to be. To speak of the good, our desire for the good, our natural desire for the ontological good, is to suggest that there is an eternal standard and an eternal order to which our will has to correspond. Well, if that's contrary to our understanding of freedom, then truly to be consistent in our belief in freedom as modern persons, must we, either implicitly but ultimately explicitly, I would think, do away with God, the good, nature as such? And, you know, let me point out, there's a reason why this seems to me a question worth asking, because the truth of the history of freedom, of the liberation of the will from the notion of a transcendent order, some of us might think has been, for the most part, a happy history. A history that set us free from antique prejudices, from confining social practices and all that. But it's also, I think we can agree, a history that has led to other things as well. Because if this is true of the will, if the will really is free to the degree that it determines itself, that if it is not bound to a notion of nature, if it is not bound to a prior eternal order of the good to which it's called, then there's absolutely no rule and no way of predicting what the employments of that freedom will be. And there's no reason why anyone should assume that the uses of freedom should be confined simply to one's individual self-realization. It's quite possible one might think instead that, well, perhaps now that we've seized this moment, now that we've experienced the history of liberation and been set free from God and from the metaphysical presuppositions that went along with that, it's time now to recreate humanity, to seize the future, to make the future what we will. Because you know, why shouldn't this be true? I mean, just think, if the myth of the modern age is that true freedom is the power of the will over nature, that is, the priority of will to nature, the power to make ourselves what we are, then, and that we're at liberty to do this, it also becomes possible to think of this as a kind of imperative. And it's perfectly logical that some, and we've seen this in the 20th century, that some should think it a noble calling to reshape the clay of humankind into something stronger and better and more rational and more efficient and more perfect. Now, the ambition to refashion humanity in its very essence, social, political, economical, moral, psychological, was inconceivable when human beings were regarded as creatures. But with the disappearance of the transcendent, it becomes possible to will a human future conformed to whatever ideals we choose to embrace. The sheer, and there is no way of determining what those ideas should be. I mean, the sheer ruthlessness of much of post-Christian idealism, in some sense, arises from the very same concept of freedom at the heart of modern Western individualism and our very comfortable and wealthy liberalism. I mean, the savagery of triumphant Jacobinism, classical socialist eugenics at the turn of the last century, the Nazi movement, Stalinism. I mean, these were all the grand utopian projects of the modern age that have spilled such oceans of human blood are no less the result of the enlightenment of the modern myth of liberation than are the liberal democratic state and the capitalist culture we enjoy. I think to deny that is to blind ourselves to a very obvious reality. But again, my question is how do we arrive at this point? That's just my explanation of why it's a pertinent question. The most enchanting narratives about the end of metaphysics or the death of God or the eclipse of the highest value that the modern age have produced are those of Nietzsche and Heidegger. They're the ones, at least, that are most haunting when you encounter them. Now, Nietzsche's account is cruder in some ways. It's also the more exhilarating. For him, we have arrived at the age of nihilism, at the age in which there are no higher values, and the age in which the will has been set free for good or ill, principally as a result of a certain kind of disease called Christianity, which, through its otherworldliness and through its ethics of pity and compassion and through so many other things, robbed this world of its glory and imparted its spiritual frailty to all of us. It also, however, and this is where Nietzsche's sort of interesting, it also, because it's just the nature of Christianity, because of its pitiless hatred of the terrestrial world, as Nietzsche would see it, its hatred of the flesh, its hatred of finite reality, conceives within itself this harsh and destructive ascetical desire for absolute truth. As I said at the beginning, when talking about Heidegger, Christianity always has within it this lust for mastering all of reality by seizing hold of the ultimate principle. And as with Plato, and as at least in Heidegger's narrative, that principle is all the more real and all the more substantial and all the more believable the less it has to do with this world, the more unlike reality it is, the more lifeless and dead it is. And this pitiless desire for ultimate truth, he believes, ultimately leads to a world devoid of the sacred, devoid of the gods. He says this happens in two stages. First, Christianity does away with all of the gods of the nations by which peoples in the past asserted their vitality as peoples, asserted their strength and their highest ideals, by concentrating the sacred in this one more or less anonymous otherworldly essence, the absolute and infinite God. And then, Christian culture in its ceaseless and pitiless pursuit of ultimate truth went so far as to discover that this God was a myth and killed him in turn. And now the world has been deprived of all values. Now, for Nietzsche, this is both good and bad. I mean, he's not someone who pines nostalgically for the days of the gods of Greece. But for him, it means that we are in a condition in which the future is at once promising and threatening. It's threatening in the sense that when we've reached this stage and we have no transcendent aspirations anymore, it is quite possible that we will simply degenerate into a species of insects, accomplishing nothing great, doing nothing worth remembering, simply living in a state of perpetual self-satisfaction. But the other possibility, of course, is that once we have discovered that transcendent aspirations, desires for God, desires for an eternal order of truth, are illusory and ultimately destructive, we can will a future. Through the sheer exercise of the will, we could will the future. For him, this willing of the future comes under the sign of the overman, the übermensch, that which is beyond the human. Rather than longing for, desiring, orienting our lives towards the transcendent God, we should now, having through a long Western history been disenchanted, the only way we can recover from the nihilism of this sort of insect-like existence is through a mighty exertion of the will. And the first thing that requires is the revaluation of all values, most especially dispensing with the poison, the toxin of Christian compassion. Now, Heidegger's different. He, rather than seeing nihilism as Christianity's corruption. Now, of course, Nietzsche also placed the part of the blame on Plato. Heidegger is very much a disciple of Nietzsche in many respects, but but Heidegger's more interesting, you know, simply because for him, Christianity's not this catastrophic event in Western history that precipitates us towards nihilism. Rather, for him, this is just the pathology of all metaphysical thought as such, all desire for the transcendent as such. Because, as I said at the beginning, for Heidegger, what philosophy is, and for him that means what culture is, because as far as he's concerned, the philosophers are the ones who more or less stand at the center of culture. They don't just express the culture around them. In some sense, they are the culture of their times. And it's from the old joke about Heidegger is that the whole history of humanity for Heidegger consists in 105 books written in Greek or German. And there's some truth in that. Some of them are written in French, but those are the bad ones. Latin. Confronted by the mystery of the world in its worlding, unwilling simply to accept that there are no names, there are no words, there are no concepts by which we can perfectly grasp this, instead of standing back peacefully and piously, as he believed certain of the oldest Greek philosophers, those who came before Socrates did, and simply allow the world to show it to us as an event and to come to utterance in our poetry and in the artifacts we make, metaphysics initiates this history of trying to master reality. But every attempt is a failure. That is, and a success. It's a success because every attempt to master reality, and whether it's Platonism or Stoicism or Christian metaphysics of the Greek fathers or later Latin medieval theology in its different forms, or modern the age of modern metaphysics and the death of metaphysics and the rebirth of metaphysics that happens between Descartes and Hegel, or anything thereafter. All of those philosophies, all of those attempts to grasp the mystery of being remind us of the mystery of being. They remind us that being is something other than simply an object in our world. But it misconstrues it every time. It tries to capture the mystery of being by turning it into an artifact of reason or turning it into an object of the will. And in so doing, it both keeps us aware of the mystery. You know, philosophy always does that. It keeps us aware of the mystery of being and at the same time blinds us to its to the mystery. And so each of these regimes of thought, each of these styles of thought and the cultures that attend them rise and fall. But where they ultimately end for him in the history of the West is, as I said, the age of technology. Because we've now, for him, arrived at the period of consummate risk. Christianity was the boldest metaphysical strategy of all, says Heidegger. The attempt to ground all of being in a supreme being and to, you know, and to make that supreme being being itself. God is once the supreme being and he is the fullness of being. With the slow and progressive collapse of the Christian synthesis, we end up now in what he calls the age of realized nihilism. Now, I see a lot actually to recommend both these stories, but I just want to alter the genealogy slightly. Nietzsche's is too catastrophic. I mean, Nietzsche exaggerates the degree to which Christianity is the Christian metaphysics uniquely elevates, well, it's a certain bad strain in Greek thought as well, but Christianity is uniquely destructive of the history of Western metaphysics and leads ultimately to nihilism. Heidegger somewhat exaggerates, though, the continuity of this tradition. And for reasons I'm not going to go into here, because I've talked too long and I didn't follow the script I had here at all because my conversation at dinner so threw me off track that I've been approaching this topic from five different angles that I didn't intend. I would argue that in point of fact, the Christian metaphysical tradition breaks. I'm going to agree with Heidegger. Yes, there is implicit in the whole metaphysical tradition of the West something that naturally leads towards where we are now. But a lot of other things are present in that tradition as well. And the uniquely Christian expression of this, I believe, for any number of reasons, does not fit the model and in a sense was an interruption of this history. But I have to say this. The sobering thing, I think, that anyone cognizant of the history of Western thought has to acknowledge is that the special, at least intellectual forces, and I say nothing about cultural or economic conditions, but the intellectual forces that led us to our modern understanding of freedom and to either an implicit or an explicit nihilism were generated within Christian theology. That the history of Christian theology is directly responsible, in some sense, for where we are now. Now, again, this theology may have been shaped and formed by other things, by certain cultural or economic realities of the late Middle Ages and of early modernity, but nonetheless, what I've been calling nihilism does not consist in this event at some point in which suddenly a great number of human beings decided to reject the Christian God. That's not what happened. There wasn't just one day when suddenly we stopped believing or stopped behaving as if we believed. Rather, the idea of the Christian God had already, to some degree, become nihilistic. Throughout most of theological history, all right, let me just reiterate, one said of God's freedom, that it consists in the liberty of the divine nature from any limitation or constraint. This is actually the definition that Augustine gives, that Gregory of Nyssa gives. God can do no evil precisely because he's perfectly free. He cannot fail to be what he is, infinite goodness itself. The ability to choose evil would be a defect in God. a limitation or a distortion of his nature. Now, for whatever reason, and it, wherever one wants to locate it, there arose first, during the late scholastic period, a theological movement that incorporated, first of all, that we generally call voluntarism, the idea that if nothing else, it placed an unprecedented emphasis upon God's will, his sovereign will, as being the first attribute, the highest attribute, the most, the primary attribute in God. But will to the exclusion of nature, a will as prior to nature, a will as higher than nature. Now, there is a history. I mean, the reason this happened, there are certain scholastics, like Henry of Ghent and others, who are responding to a certain sort of heretical Islamic scholasticism that's come through Spain, especially through the thought of Avicenna or Ibn Sina. But for whatever reason, slowly, the idea emerged that in order properly to assert God's omnipotence, properly, piously, to pay due and reverential respect to God's divinity, it was necessary to say that his will, in some sense, was absolute as regards even good and evil. And this becomes quite explicit in the thinker like William of Ockham, late scholastic, or of Thomas Bradwardine, both of whom said that something is not, God does not command that which is good. That which is good because God commands it. That is, his will is not obedient to his nature as God. His will does not follow from his divine goodness. And the good that he requires of us is not something with which we are by nature continuous or which necessarily leads to our union with God. Rather, the good, the divine law, is an expression of the divine will. And to say less than that, and to suggest that God's will could even be constrained by God's own nature, would be somehow to diminish the freedom of God. And this is a radically different notion of freedom. And it happens within Christian thought. And by the period of early modernity, in Western theology at least, at this point, my Eastern Orthodoxy allows me to claim no complicity of any of my theological forebears in this history. It is simply the case that this is the God that we're talking about. Even when the language that's being used seems to say otherwise. I'm at a Dominican college this year. I don't know how many of you may have ever heard of, say, the De Auxiliis controversy. Anyone recognize that? Okay. And this is an argument between, in the late 16th century, early 17th century, between Jesuits and Dominicans. Jesuits, the Molinists, and the Bagnesian Thomists. They all think they're interpreting Thomas Aquinas, and that's disputable. But what's interesting, if one goes back to read these documents, is that at some level, all of them presume that the issue that is most important for theology is to defend God's absolute freedom from any constraint in the employment of his will. One side, the Bagnesians, the Thomists, the Dominicans, the people who like burning people, as I like to call them. They still do, I've discovered. They just don't get as many opportunities. But I've met a few Dominicans this year who always keep a book of matches under their robes just in case the opportunity. They certainly, I think, wouldn't mind throwing the occasional Eastern Orthodox on the grill. Let me give you an example. The Bagnesian interpretation of Thomas, and it's in keeping with some of Thomas, but it's a very limited reading, is firmly predestinarian. They knew that from the earlier Catholic tradition, they had to say that God was not the cause of evil, and that God really does create free creatures, and yet at the same time, by the period of the late 16th century, it is impossible for them to say this coherently. Because the way in which the Banyasian tradition explains how God creates free people, but nonetheless is not challenged in his omnipotence over all creation, is that he employs something, he permits evil, but his permission of evil isn't that he just lets it happen. He eternally permissively decrees evil. So that whatever sin you commit, God has eternally permissively decreed infallibly that you will commit. But it's a permission. It's not God forcing you, except it is. And whatever good you do or don't, that too has been eternally decreed. And both actions are actions that are only possible because God exercises something called a premotio physica upon your will, that is, a physical premotion. He's not just the good calling you to himself. He is the efficient physical force driving your will towards one end or the other. And he has eternally decreed what you... But you're free. The reason you're free... Now, you know, this kind of works. If you don't think about it, it works at least. The reason you're free... I'm sorry to be making fun of Dominicans, but it's become a habit this year. The reason you're free is because freedom is the logical condition of whatever you do not having been determined by your prior proximate cause. That means in the world of finite causes, okay, what you choose to do is not determined by what just happened a moment ago. You still are free. But nonetheless, you will do what God forces you to do by his premotio physica. But God, you see, isn't working through the causes behind you. He's working from above. And so, and this is a phrase I've heard from a Thomist recently who's in this tradition and thinks it's a grand tradition, the will is free because it is not causally determined by any temporal sequence of events. It's free because it's eternally predetermined to do what it does. All right. They have arguments that almost make this sound like it sounds like it were, but they're actually very bad arguments. But why am I making an issue of this? It's just you've arrived at a point in Western history in which, and it's no coincidence that this is also the time the birth of modern science was being made possible by the mechanical philosophy. Now, if those of you who don't know what that means, I mean, in the vaguest, most general sense, it just means that rather than in the old Aristotelian, or the classical, or the Christian medieval sense, thinking in terms of various kinds of causality, you know, a final cause, the end towards which anything develops, a formal cause, the form that impresses itself, material and efficient. Everything has been just reduced to the idea of an efficient cause. I mean, what all of reality is understood principally in terms of that efficient force, that power, that force that makes things happen. And within this environment, the only way you can plausibly say God is omnipotent is to say that he acts as an absolutely overwhelming, irresistible, efficient force that guides, that determines everything that happens. Moreover, and this is the important thing in this tradition, the Banyasians were also fiercely insistent that God could have created any world he wanted. There's no reason he created this world rather than another, because there are an infinite number of possible worlds. All of them would be infinitely inferior to God, so there's no best of all possible worlds. And he has from eternity determined and forced to come about through the use of this promotio physica, the salvation of a few and the damnation of most, not on the basis of anything inherent in the creature, right? It's ante praevisa merita. It's before any foreknowledge he might have of the character or actions of the creature. He has determined this from eternity solely that his sovereignty might be displayed. That his power, he doesn't use the terms, Banyas doesn't say sovereignty, he says goodness. And that goodness needs to be displayed both in the mercy of an unmerited redemption and in the eternal ferocity of a fully merited damnation. And you need these orders of damnation and salvation for the full glorious spectacle of God's power to be visible. And, I mean, this is happening in Catholic theology. It's also in Protestant theology. I mean, I don't need to tell you, I would think, that similar language is to be found in the Calvinist tradition without the Promotio Physica, but and in Lutheran tradition. This is the modern Christian God in the West to a very real degree, not for everyone. It's also the God that people have now heard about because of the printing press. You know, throughout most of history, in the West as in the East, Christians have been semi-Pelagians. That is, they believe that everything comes from God, but they have to do good works to be saved. I mean, this is what most Christians have believed down the ages. There was no printing press. Most medieval Christians, most ancient Christians were largely, especially medieval Christians, because the theological preaching was iffy in most of the, you know, throughout most of its history, apparently, from what we can deduce. In the age of the printing press, this God, the God who seems first and foremost to be a God of sovereign will, a God who fits very well into the age of the mechanical philosophy, this God gives us a model of human, of what freedom is. And what freedom is the spontaneous power of the will to decide and to do and to act. And if that's what freedom is for God, then in some sense that's what freedom must be for us. It's a natural process that over the years this image of divine freedom will migrate to the human and become an image of human freedom. What is it to be free? It is the freedom of sheer sovereignty. The sovereignty of the nation state, the sovereignty of the individual, the sovereignty of the property owner, what have you. Sovereignty. Power of the will. Not obedience to one's nature, not desire for the good, but first and foremost, the unpremised, spontaneous employment of the power of the will. And if that's what freedom is, then God is the ultimate rival to our freedom. God, rather than being the infinite source of the good that sets us free, as he would be in the more antique notion of freedom, God, rather than God being that eternal good that sets us free for itself, that gives us a nature and sets us free from our own ignorance and vice and cruelty and violence, God is now just the biggest individual around. And he is our enemy. But not only does he give us the model of freedom, he is, and I think, just forgive me for putting this so bluntly, he also happens to be evil. Because if that's how predestination works, if it is this causal force directly determining all things for the display of sovereignty, then he's a God beyond good and evil. He is a God totally beyond good and evil, and to be beyond good and evil is simply to be evil. And over the course of time, why should one continue to believe in such a God? Such a God should die. The death of God, the slow retreat of faith, seems to me almost a thing desirable by contrast. You know, it seems like an odd place to be leading to, but I'm very near the end. You might be disappointed at this point. It is a bit where it's going to sound really nasty, awful. Okay, sorry. Okay. The Heidegger, whom I often have mixed, I've said mixed things about, let's just put it that way. Before I finish, let me just return this. I've been reading Heidegger for 20 years and more, and I think there's certain phrases in Heidegger that I've listened to, and I said, yeah, it's kind of true. But I didn't want to hear them from Heidegger. Because, you know, he wasn't a Christian, or at least he had been. He was baptized and he was buried as a Catholic, but he wasn't. But he also wasn't an atheist. He hated vulgar atheism, too. He just believed we were in an age when it was impossible to talk intelligibly about God because the idea of God had been so corrupted in being just pure causality, pure force, being just the kind of God I've just been describing to you. He despaired over much of the ability to talk about God, but he was quite right in believing that most of the language we use about God is inherently corrupt in the modern age. And And he said, one of the most famous, and it's often been lampooned, I've done it myself, so I can't. Let me put it. He's talking about how modern philosophy from Descartes onward thinks of God just as sheer causality, to the point where God is defined as causa sui, self-cause, cause of himself. Causa efficiens, pure efficient causality. This is the God, he says, from whom all holiness and mystery and transcendence has been stolen away. And he says, God come in Licht der Kausalität zu einer Ursache. In this light of causality, he is reduced simply to cause. The cause is causa sui. And this is the right name for the God of philosophy. And this is notorious science. Zu diesem Gott kann der Mensch weder beten, noch kann ihm opfern. To this God, man can neither pray nor make sacrifices. Before the causa sui, kann der Mensch weder aus Scheu ins Knie fallen, cannot fall on his knees, nor can er vor diesem Gott musizieren und tanzen. Neither can he before this God make music and dance. And maybe the godless thinking which must abandon this God is perhaps closer to the truly divine God. Maybe, he says, this godless thinking is more open to him than ontotheologic. That's his name for metaphysics, but specifically from the period of Descartes onward. He doesn't actually say that of medieval philosophies. Maybe it is freer for him, more open for him, freier für ihn. It's a very powerful line. But I have to say, this is an odd place to draw to a close, but I just wanted to be, you asked me to explain why I'm fascinated by it. This is not a brief for atheism, but I will say this much. It's sort of a charitable understanding, hope charitably to understand. I do think that the modern understanding of freedom, which is the result of theology at some level, is inherently nihilistic. I think it must be. But I also think that nihilism in the sense of rejection of belief in God has happened in Western culture because of certain corruptions within Western culture so destructive and so profoundly wrong that in some sense atheism is a preferable alternative. And it's possible that the West, being for the most part the only sort of religiously atheist culture in development, in Western Europe especially. I mean, atheists not... Actually, it turns out most Europeans believe in God in some sense, but I mean, just most rejecting this history of Christian belief, that even in that atheism, there is a trace of a more original conscience. The atheism, so-called, of the early Christians who rejected idolatries, who rejected gods of power and gods of the nations, and gods who were not worthy of worship. And that I'm not, like Heidegger, I don't just want to sit around and wait to see what God will show himself. But I have to say, just as a charitable interpretation of this history, and why I find this, in one dimension of this, so fascinating, is that it may be that the charitable Christian approach to this culture of nihilism that has been created by the failure of Christian civilization and Christian thought and Christian practice should also be seen as a period in which, if it's taken as a form of asceticism, as a relinquishing of false understandings of God and false desire for the God, the God of standards. I mean, that's not enough. Could also be seen as the possibility of learning slowly again to remember the God whom St. Paul proclaimed as the enemy of the principalities and powers and dominions and thrones, the enemy of unjust rule. And I think I'll stop there because I think I've gone way past the time I should. This is what you've done to me by getting me off my own topic. No. Thank you.
Be helpful in my response. I, of course, because as you can tell, the talk was given extempore. This is the first time I'm hearing it as well. Matt did supply me with at least three of David Benninghart's works, and I read them closely, and I read them with a great deal of interest. I actually was very impressed indeed. I learned quite a lot from them. And I say that, with sincerity. What I would like to do, I guess, is try to explain in the 10 minutes or so that I have my problem with his approach to the question. Let me just begin with the fact that we heard in his talk a number of competing definitions for freedom. And I think we also heard a number of competing definitions of nihilism. What worries me is that when I present my critique here now, it will always be possible to adopt a position of plausible deniability, and one can move rather easily from one to the other of these definitions to say that that's really what was meant all along. And I say that not fatuously. I'm trying to make a point here about a theological intervention, which I think it's fair to characterize his talk as being, as well as the writing that I read in preparation for my comments today, that a theological intervention that is of the sort that he's constructed so artfully is one that works rhetorically because it is gesturing towards a philosophical tradition that operates according to a different set of rules. So I would say, first off, that what I notice in his presentation today is a radical disjunction between the first two-thirds of the talk and a sudden departure into the discourse of perfect freedom, of a God that can do no evil, of God's omnipotency, and then, of course, the inevitable citing of a number of theological authorities, in this case Avicenna, William of Ockham, and others. So there's kind of a dissimulation, I would say, that lies at the heart of this kind of approach that I would like to call to question. The first thing I would say, too, that struck me in the reading of his work is that although there would not be any apparent reason for this to be the case, what draws him, in fact, to Heidegger and Nietzsche, who, of course, ostensibly would not be the kinds of philosophical resources that one would point to or draw on in a theology of any sort, is right at the center of the hegemonic viewpoint in cultural theory, largely characterized by the press and by public pundits as being Marxist, communist, atheist, secular humanist, and so on. That what we're finding in this employment, or deployment, one might say, of Heidegger and Nietzsche in this particular approach of David Benninghart's is much larger than a particular spin or gloss that he's giving to theological traditions. It's, in fact, the center of contemporary theory within the academy, as espoused by a series of former radicals from 68, who now are professors of literature and philosophy. And so what we really need to understand is what is it that lies at the core of Nietzsche and Heidegger in this modernity that in some ways is being condemned, I think, in his talk, but in other ways I would argue is being reinforced, that would draw him and them, unlike though they be, to the same philosophical sources. What strikes me, too, right here at the beginning, is that there are so many philosophical resources that could have been drawn on that are not. I've just come from a a seminar this afternoon in which I was teaching the work of Slavoj Žižek. Many of you might know him, but he is a Slovenian philosopher and a social critic who teaches at the University of London and is a head of an institute there. He's extraordinarily prolific and very influential right now. He is a Leninist. He is one of the emigres from Eastern Europe who does not feel that communism was misbegotten. He's attempting, in fact, to argue very vigorously on behalf of the necessity, in fact, of having gone through communism, and the need to desperately get away from Western capitalism and its modernity and its illusory free choice. And I think, and this is a very good point I think that you made, the many unrecognized crimes that were committed in the name of liberal capitalism. So in many ways, Žižek is not the kind of person that you would expect to argue what he argues so forcefully at the center of this recent book of his called The Parallax View. His argument is about freedom, in fact. It's an argument, however, that's drawing not from Heidegger and Nietzsche, the philosophical resources of the moment in the contemporary era, but on Hegel, the person who is supposedly to blame for the excesses of communism and the fallacious conclusions of Marxism. What he says about freedom is that freedom is choosing what was necessary anyway. And I find that to be disruptive in some ways of the argument that we've heard today, partly because it has no bearing whatsoever on theology. It's drawn entirely from an Enlightenment notion of freedom understood as civic freedom. And this is a dimension that I can't go without mentioning, that went without mentioning in the presentation that we heard today. There were interesting, I think, connections drawn between nihilism and freedom in this talk, but there was never any indication, not even for a moment, that freedom involved what the Enlightenment helped bring about, voting, for example, access to education, equality before the law, and questions like this. What I think someone like Žižek is really alluding to in making the statement that he did about freedom is that it is the Hegelian tradition that the Heideggerian and Nietzschean traditions were precisely within the history of philosophy mobilizing themselves to destroy. And it is the Hegelian tradition that brings philosophy as active critique into the civic realm and asks people to draw the conclusion that for them to retain or win for the first time some of these rights understood in a civic sense, they need to place a limitation on their freedom of choice. So what I guess I'm trying to get at, and I don't have very much time to do it, is that there is a conflict that's going on that's represented by a book like Žižek's between philosophical lineages that now have taken place and taken hold within the academy that attempt to slough off and throw off any sense of the limitations imposed by authority, by order, of any sort. So they would be opposed, for example, to marriage. They would be opposed to strictures imposed by the state, any state. All states are negative in this point of view. This line of thinking comes out of what I would argue is an essentially Nietzschean tradition in philosophy. And it's against that that somebody like Žižek is attempting to mobilize his quite different sense of freedom as the choosing of what is necessary anyway. A few more points so that I don't take up too much time. What I'm going to say, I think, bears somewhat on the talk that you gave today, although necessarily it bears more on some of the reading that I did for this. I think that it's fair to say that David Bentley Hart finds fault in a system in which the individual is conceived as falling into a situation where they must choose among several varieties of moral law and moral standards, as though it were a mere fashion of piety. That is, he's very against the relativism of moral value, something that one can either try on or take off as they see fit. And I agree with him. I also am opposed to that. And there's many other things that we found at dinner, as he alluded to, that we agree on. But the burden, of course, when you take a position like that, is to prove that his own moral system is not itself a chosen standard rather than a divinely received one. And this, I think, he cannot do. He makes a number of links between the irreligious and capitalist modernity. He disapproves of capitalist modernity in part because it puts forward to us an illusory choice. And again, I agree with this diagnosis entirely. But I would think that it's much fairer to say, particularly in the current conjunction, it's almost amazing that one can deliver a talk like this and not make this prominent, that there's a link rather between the religious, at least a certain version of religion, involving, as it does, the leaps of faith that I was identifying in the radical disjunction in his own talk, and the capitalistic. It is the irreligious and the capitalistic that belong together, it seems to me. I think that there's some problem in the talk as well in the lurking Eurocentrism at its core. My wife happens to be Bengali, and I spend a lot of time in India, and I think that what strikes one there is not so much the debates for or against this or that theological verity, but the sheer irrelevance of Christianity in a country like India. And this, of course, would extend as well to American popular culture. I think that we're very frequently under the assumption that everybody in other parts of the world knows all about Hollywood film and cares about it and is up on the latest American fashions. It's very, very, very far from the case. Linguistically, politically, culturally, and in terms of religion, India just does not care about the United States, nor Christianity, more importantly. And I think that this particular rather vulgar, rather blunt fact diminishes somewhat the force of the rather intricate, highly erudite fine-tunings that go on in this argument about nihilism and freedom within the Christian tradition. Basically, I think that Professor Hart believes philosophical inquiry is objectionable because it only leads us to a melancholy apprehension that the perfect one, that is the divine principle, is distant from the mutable and multiple reality of our existence. The search for this one lying behind the impure multiples of the imperfect material real, therefore, according to him, demands a detachment from flesh in order to find truth in the oblivion of the flesh, a pure nothingness, what Heidegger and company call metaphysics. This is that belief in nothing, in nihilism of which he speaks. But this would seem to not only to foreshorten and conflate the materialist philosophical traditions that lie outside of phenomenology, and to take Heideggerianism rather naively, in my opinion, at its word. Even more importantly, this position necessitates the positing of a merely given ground. Again, the argument I'm making might seem somewhat obscure, but I'm trying to make the argument that once you enter this territory of theology that's motivating itself by reference to the rhetoric of philosophical discourse, you now have taken on a number of possible attacks against you. And I'm trying to say that what's going on here is a slippage in which the allusion to certain authorities is bolstering an argument that is based on a merely given ground, a ground that is not established philosophically. It is fundamentally unable to assign itself a task that is not predetermined in advance, and therefore rules out of discussion an evidentiary or rational or internally consistent means by which to arrive at conclusions that may not have been foreseen. The very quest for truth that might lead to a conclusion that was not foreseen is anathema, I think, in this particular theology that we heard today and in his writings, although no doubt I know that he'll probably contest that point. I think that the slippage into the theological discourse at the end allows the discourse of nihilism, importantly, to shift and to turn our attention away from the original way in which he to find it. What I think we're led to do is talk about God as a solution once again, who will in this way be talked about as an everything that can exist without reference to anything. A being that is everything depending upon his untranslatability into anything. And this happens to be, for those of you who know Heidegger's philosophy, precisely the move that Heidegger himself makes in his distinction between the ontic and the ontological. I've taken up too much time. Let me conclude with one more point, and this follows directly on the point that I've just made, and I think is defensible on the grounds of the degree to which the talk was about the tradition of Nietzsche and Heidegger. There is, I would argue, in this mode of argumentation, this theological mode of argumentation that is presented through a rhetoric of philosophical discourse in a dissimulated fashion, there is an authoritarian strain, it seems to me, in this, that is in fact quite conducive to and logically follows from the Nietzsche and the Heidegger that he's drawing from. That is, it's not merely that there's a distancing from these rather far-right, politically reactionary thinkers from which one can simply gather some intellectual sustenance and then transform it into something completely different. I think, in fact, in the move that's made that I'm about to state in one last way, a continuation of an authoritarian strain that sees social justice, freedom, ethics, and morality in an authoritarian way, and it is this peremptory gesture that weds him to the thinking of the ontological hermeneutical tradition of Nietzsche and Heidegger. From his point of view, he adopts aspects of their war against Western nihilism and metaphysics in the name of its concealed theological truth. However, what has really happened, in other words, the turn that Heidegger initiates in philosophy from epistemology, from knowing, from what can we actually understand about the world? Do we have a way of making the world? Are we agents? Can we transform the world? All of those questions which were fully on the agenda in philosophy are overturned by Heidegger for reactionary reasons, for reasons of consciously on his part trying to outmaneuver the then dominant Hegelian tradition. And what he attempts to do is turn our attention instead to ontology, to the contemplation of being, to the revelation of the mystery of being, and so on, right? Which is a way of turning philosophical inquiry inward and providing, quite consciously, again, an inquiry that leads to stasis, to intellectual stasis, to the contemplation of the mind contemplating the thing that can never fully reveal itself. This is the kind of move that's going on. That is, I think, being referenced here in this talk as looking at what Heidegger did not understand was true about his own philosophy. However, I think what's really going on is a kind of outing of, through a fealty with, the authoritarian strain regnant in that philosophical tradition, as well as the religious obscurantism at the core of Heideggerian jargon. So that's my gauntlet that I found.
We have just a few minutes left, but I'd like to take your questions. So if you'll just raise your hand, I'd like to have you speak right into the microphone.
Oh, that's first person?
Yeah, you're first.
That's first person.